Right, good morning, everyone. So we are bringing the series into landing, and we hope that you have gone to or are going to new heights in your leadership. But so we've been kind of looking at these Old Testament legends, Old Testament characters, learning from them. But when we think of great leaders, we often think of two aspects. We think of their unique characteristics, or we think of what they've achieved. And so when we think of Joshua, whom we saw last week, we think, wow, just an incredibly courageous leader. Daunting task. I mean, Moses died and he had to take over leading the nation of Israel into the promised land. And it wasn't an easy task. He had to take out something like 31 kings to possess the land. So a courageous leader. And then we looked at Joseph. And when we think of him, we think, wow, just an awesome servant leader. Served in, you know, no matter the circumstance, because he trusted in the sovereign plan of God over his life. And then when we think of more current, even secular leaders, we think of the late Steve Jobs. We think, gosh, just an incredible creative genius to bring about Apple. Or we think of Richard Branson, who is just this entrepreneurial genius. He started his first business at the age of 16 and has never looked back. He's a multi-billionaire. And so when we look at these leaders, we think, wow, unique characteristics, unique legacies that they've left. But we often don't stop and think about their hearts, the leader's heart, or as the Bible describes it, as our inner man, our inner nature, the inner you. Because it's our heart that actually determines what type of leader we are, or what type of leader we can be. Our hearts determine our character. You know, what level of integrity are you going to have? Our hearts determine our motives. Are you going to have selfish motives in how you lead, or are you going to have God-honoring motives? And our hearts determine what we worship or who we worship. Do we worship money? Do we worship status? Or do we worship God? Are our hearts saturated in God? Jesus said this in Matthew 12, 34. He said that out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. So in other words, how you lead and what you do is as a result of the condition of your heart. What's going on in your heart determines what you say, and what you say determines what you do, and what you do and say determines ultimately how you lead your life and lead others. And so as Christians whose hearts have been, let's say, ravished by the sovereign grace of Jesus, have been regenerated by Jesus, we need to protect these hearts so that we can lead our families, we can lead our children, lead our employees, lead our company, lead our community groups, be on mission for Jesus in the city in a way that brings glory to God. And so the next legend I want us to look at is Solomon, is King Solomon. Now, naturally, when we think of Solomon, we think maybe of his incredible wealth or his incredible wisdom, but as we go through the story, I want to show you that the issue is actually the condition of his heart. Because your gifts and your talents and your wealth and your resources, your experience might open many doors for you. But it's the condition of your heart that will determine the legacy that you leave. And as Christians, we want our legacy to be God glorified. We want our legacies to show off Jesus. And so how do we protect our hearts then as godly leaders? So first point goes like this as we look at Solomon. We protect or guard our hearts by praying for a hearing heart. Now before I explain what that means, let me give you some context. So Solomon is David's son, you know, David and Goliath, David. And David is on his deathbed. And he calls Solomon over to him. Now, I don't want to give too much away about David. We're going to do a whole series on him. But just an incredible man. He loved God, and God loved him. And so Solomon had some pretty big shoes to fill. And so David's on his deathbed. He calls his son over, and he says this to him in 1 Kings 2, verse 1. He says, "When David's time to die drew near, he commanded Solomon his son, saying, 'I am about to go the way of all the earth. Be strong and show yourself a man and keep the charge of the Lord your God, walking in his ways, keeping his statutes, his commandments, his rules, and his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses,'" here's why, "'that you may prosper in all that you do and wherever you turn. that the Lord may establish his word that he spoke concerning me, saying this. Now listen to this. This is very important. So God comes to David and says something about his sons. He says, if your sons pay close attention to their way, to walk before me in faithfulness with all of their heart, that's our key term, and with all their soul, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. So no pressure here, Saul, but you got to keep an eye on that heart of yours. If it wanders off, if it wanders off the ways of God and the law of God, then this promise to your dad, suddenly on shaky ground. So what does a 20-year-old man, scholars reckon he was 20 years old when he was called to be king or president of the nation of Israel. What does he do? What every leader should do when they call to a daunting task. When you're out of your comfort zone, out of your capacity, out of your ability, you pray. And so God appears to Solomon in a dream one day. And he says, okay, Saul, now that you're king, what do you want from me? What can I give you? You imagine that? Now that you're a father, now that another child's on the way, Jason, what do you want? Well, you know, can you imagine? So here's Solomon's response, far more biblical than mine. 1 Kings 3, verse 7, he says, and now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king in place of David my father. Although I am but a little child, I do not know how to go out or come in. In other words, I'm clueless. And your servant is in the midst of your people whom you have chosen, a great people, too many to be numbered or counted for multitude. So they've grown, the nation of Israel. They're huge now. So he says, give your servant, therefore, an understanding mind, or quite literally in the Hebrew, a hearing heart, to govern your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to govern this, your great people? So we learn some amazing things about Christian leadership in this prayer. The first thing that we learn, the first thing that we are to implement is acknowledge that you can't do it. Whatever leadership capacity you find yourself in, at home, at work, leading yourself, admit that you can't do it. And it's totally countercultural. You won't find that in the business aisle, in exclusive books, in the self-help books. In fact, they'll tell you, you need to wake up every morning, stand in front of the mirror and say, you can do it 10 times. And say, I am worthy 10 times. I mean, yes, when we think of Joshua, we think, yes, courageous leader, but his courage was rooted in God. His courage was rooted in the faithfulness and the promises God made him. And so Solomon uses phrases like little child. I feel like a little child compared to this task that I have to do. He says, I do not know how to go out or come in. So he admits his inexperience. He admits his inability to govern this people whom he says is too large even to be counted. Secondly, he calls himself God's servant. He declares his dependence on God and more importantly, his desire to govern this nation according to God's will. Not his. I'm here to serve you, God. I want to govern these people according to your will, not mine. So how's he going to do this? He says then, thirdly, he asks for an understanding mind, or literally a hearing heart, to hear God, to govern properly, to judge accurately between good and evil. And so God is so impressed with the heart attitude of Solomon that he decides to give Solomon unprecedented wisdom. And on top of that, because he didn't ask for victory over his enemies or a long life or honor and glory, he decides to give him that too. Have a look at this. But then he tags on a warning at the end. Okay, look here. 1 Kings 3 verse 12, he says, behold, I give you a wise and discerning mind, so that none like you has ever been or has been before you, and none like you shall arise after you. So you think of all the geniuses. You think of Einstein and all those kinds of guys. No one has been as clever as this man. He says, I give you also what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that no other king shall compare with you all your days. That comes the condition. And if you will walk in my ways, keeping my statutes and my commandments as your father David walked, then I will lengthen your days. So here's the deal, Saul. I'm going to give you the whole package. I'll grant you your wisdom, and on top of that, I'll give you riches and honor and glory. But you have to guard that heart of yours, keeping my ways and my laws. Then I will lengthen your days. You will reign for a long time. So Solomon starts off incredibly well. And his wise governance becomes legendary very quickly. The most famous story is two prostitutes come before him. The one prostitute's got a baby. And the one who doesn't says, "She stole my baby. Her baby actually died in the night last night. And then she came and she stole my baby. That's my baby." So how is Solomon supposed to prove this now? I mean, today we've got DNA testing. We can go, investigate the crime scene and interview possible fathers. And so Solomon, he cuts straight to the chase. Excuse the pun. He says, "Bring me that sword." He says, "I'm going to chop this baby in half. You can have half. You can have the other half." The real mom is horrified. She says, no. She can keep him. She can keep him. As long as he's alive, she can keep him. Solomon says, "Case closed. She's the real mom. Hand the baby over." And this spreads like wildfire, not just within the nation of Israel, but the surrounding nations. And then next minute, he's composing symphonies. He's hoping, he's hosting like BC National Geographic conferences. Look at this. This is amazing. Chapter 4, verse 32. He also spoke 3,000 proverbs, little wise sayings, and his songs were 1,005. So they came to his concerts, 1,005 songs. He spoke of trees from the cedar that is in Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of the wall. I mean, so you're walking along and he sees a little shrubbery growing out of the wall of his car. He says, "Let me just tell you about this little root system that enables this plant to be able to grow out of a wall." Everyone's like, "Oh." Anyway. So he carries on. He spoke also of beasts and of birds and of reptiles and of fish. I mean, he's the ultimate zoologist, botanist, you name it. And people of all nations came to hear the wisdom of Solomon and from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. Amazing. Unprecedented wisdom. All because he started off by asking for a hearing heart. I just need wisdom, God. I just need understanding, discernment. Now, I don't know what leadership position you're in. Maybe you're just trying to raise your kids as best you can. Maybe you're in a very stressful position at work. Maybe you're a CEO of a company. Maybe you've taken over a company. Maybe you're leading a community group. Maybe you're just a student trying to stay afloat on top of all of the work and the exams. Maybe you're just trying to turn your life around. You've got bad habits and you're just trying to stop those things and go down the right path. And you're trying to do all of this by bringing glory and honor to God. You're trying to protect your heart from fear because maybe some of you are in incredibly daunting positions and places right now. And so you're trying to protect your heart from fear from paralyzing you in that situation. Or maybe some of you are doing incredibly well and you're trying not to let pride infect your heart. And you want to do everything in a God-glorifying way. And so we do this by following Solomon's example at this stage. He says this. This is what we need to do. I can't do this. You declare your dependence. I can't do this. I am like a child who lacks understanding. And then we declare that I am your servant. I am your servant, God, here to serve you in whatever capacity according to your will, not mine. And to do this, we ask for a hearing heart. We ask for wisdom. We ask for understanding. The brother of Jesus, James, says this in verse 5 of chapter 1 of his book. He says, if any of you lacks wisdom, if you lack wisdom, if you lack understanding, if you don't know what to do in your particular situation, he says, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. Ask Covenant Grace. No matter what you're going through, ask. Because he gives generously so that you can lead your families, you can lead your company, you can lead yourself in a way that brings him glory because it's according to his wisdom. So that's point number one. A godly leader protects his heart or her heart by asking for a hearing heart. Number two goes like this. We protect our hearts by using our gifts or our capacities, our resources, whatever it might be, to the glory of God and the good of people. So back to Solomon. What do you do when you are the cleverest person alive? When you can understand anything, when there's not a single problem that you cannot solve, what do? I mean, the world literally becomes your oyster. To borrow that line from one of the Spider-Man movies, with great power comes great responsibility. Seen the movie too? So, are you going to use your gifts and your talents and your resources to build your own kingdom? Or are you going to use them for the glory of God and for the good of other people? So here's what Solomon does. Firstly, he uses his unparalleled wisdom to become the ultimate political diplomat. What I mean by that is, never in the history of the nation of Israel had they experienced so much peace than under the reign of Solomon. David, his father, was a brilliant king, but his reign was characterized by war and tension. But under Solomon, they had the most peaceful period ever, because he used his gift to bring his people peace and prosperity. But the most significant thing Solomon did with his great wisdom and his great wealth was build the most impressive temple to God. See, up until that point in history, there wasn't a permanent dwelling place where the people of Israel could come and worship God and offer sacrifices to God. There wasn't a permanent dwelling where the presence of God could come down and be with his people. And so in his fourth year, Solomon decides to use all of his wisdom and creativity and all of his resources, his wealth, to build this temple for his people and for the glory of God. And they describe it like this. It was constructed in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah. The temple was approximately 30 meters long, 10 meters wide, and about 3 stories high. So not unlike this structure. David, his father, had contributed his personal wealth and extensive amounts of timber, stone, iron, bronze, silver, and gold. Okay, so David didn't build it, but he gathered resources for his son to build it. Then Solomon, too, personally purchased and imported lumber and stone. Now listen to this. Almost 200,000 of his own people, that's Israelites, labored to transport materials to Jerusalem. So they'd go to these quarries miles and miles away, and they'd quarry out these huge big stones and carry them all the way back to Jerusalem. The interior of the temple was decorated with detailed carvings and plated with over 20 tons of gold. So imagine a building like this, magnificent carvings all over the place, all plated in gold. And it took 7 years to construct it. But when it was finished, it was one of a kind. And then Solomon throws this massive, massive opening ceremony, kind of like, you know, the Olympic opening ceremony on roids, like just huge opening ceremony for the entire nation. And then they parade the Ark of the Covenant, which has the law in it, right into the temple, to the Holy of Holies. And as soon as they put it down, the whole temple is filled with the presence of God in the form of a cloud, an intense cloud, so much so that the priests had to make a hasty retreat. And then, on an elevated scaffold, so you've got to pretend, so maybe this is the temple, Solomon then constructed a scaffolding next to the temple. He climbs all the way to the top, gets down on his knees, stretches out his arms, and he prays the most incredible prayer to God and for his people. And after he finished praying, they then offered up offerings and sacrifices, including 22,000 oxen and 120,000 sheep. He did not spare any expense for his people and for his God. And so the entire nation of Israel worshipped and they praised God for like 7 days. And on the 8th day, he sends them home. But look at what the text says, 1 Kings 8:66. He says, on the 8th day, he sent the people away, and they blessed the king and went to their homes joyful and glad of heart for all the goodness that the Lord had shown to David, his servant, and to Israel, his people. An amazing picture. The entire nation is blessed, full of joy, and so grateful to their king. Thank you, King Solomon, for using your incredible wisdom, creativity, and resources to build this temple so that we can come and worship our God. We can come and offer sacrifices to our God. And he's found pleasure in your building because he's graced us with his presence. Now, before we move on to the last point, we have to make some application to our lives. Because this point just begs the question, how are we doing when it comes to using our resources, our talents, our gifts? Are we using them for the glory of God and for the good of people? And the secret behind the answer is the condition of your heart. When Solomon, while he was praying for the nation of Israel on top of that scaffolding, he prays this incredible prayer. Look at this, chapter 8, verse 57. He says, "The Lord our God be with us as he was with our fathers. May he not leave us or forsake us," and look at this, "that he may incline our hearts to him." And the purpose of that? "To walk in his ways and to keep his commandments, his statutes and his rules, which he commanded our fathers." So do you see that? He asks God to come and incline their hearts. He asks God to slant their heart's desires or shift their heart's desires towards him and his ways. Why would he need to pray that? Because our hearts are born sinful and selfish. We naturally want to fulfill our own sinful passions and desires at the expense of God's glory and at the expense of the good of others. And secondly, we're simply powerless to change our hearts ourselves. Paul tells the Ephesians in Ephesians 2 verse 1 that we are born dead in our sins and trespasses. A spiritually dead person cannot change his spiritually dead heart. He needs a miracle. And so New Testament language or New Covenant language, which is what we're under, says something like this, that God comes by his grace and by his mercy and he regenerates our hearts. He gives us a new heart. He takes out that heart of stone and puts a heart of flesh in there, empowered by the Spirit to walk according to his ways. And so he does this by his sovereign grace through faith in Jesus. But we still have a responsibility. We still have a responsibility to live out these new desires from this new heart. That's why Solomon continues in his prayer and he says this in verse 61. He says, "Let your heart, therefore, in light of God, in light of what God has done, in light of God inclining your heart, be wholly true to the Lord our God, walking in his statutes and keeping his commandments as at this day." So your regenerated heart, your heart that has been inclined by God, for God, and to God, it wants to live for God. It wants to use your resources and your talents for the glory of God and for the good of others. It finds full satisfaction and joy in that alone, because that's how it's been designed. So like Solomon prays, he says, let your heart do this. Put off those old sinful passions and selfish passions from that old heart that's dying out and put on the new heart with its new desires to serve God. Because the fruit of guarding this new heart, the fruit of it is a desire for God. Is a desire to serve for his glory and for the service of others. Now, if we stop there in the story, we could naturally conclude that Solomon's got to be the greatest king that ever walked this planet. I mean, wow, just incredibly intellectual, full of resources, very wealthy, and he used all of it to build God's kingdom, not build his own fame. He's jealous for the glory of God, and he's jealous for the good of his people. But not all is as it seems. Because the author of this story, brilliantly written, he uses a literary technique called irony. And the whole story is littered with ironic statements. Now, an ironic statement has two meanings. I'm sure you'll know what it is. But, you know, the first surfacey level is not actually the true meaning. It's the underlying meaning. So if you come home on Friday afternoon and you say to your wife, "I have to work the whole weekend," and she says, "Nice." Surface meaning, she's cool with it? No. The true meaning is the underlying meaning, because the context tells us what the true meaning of that statement is. So no one would pick up on this irony in the story unless you knew the context surrounding the laws given to the kings of Israel. So the story goes that Israel, they didn't want to be a theocracy anymore. They said to God, we want to have a normal king like the other nations. And so God says, cool, I'll give you a king, but let me give you some rules and some laws to go with this king. And they go like this, Deuteronomy 17, verse 15. He says, you may not put a foreigner over you who is not your brother. Okay, so he has to be an Israelite. Solomon ticks the box. Then he says, only he must not acquire many horses for himself or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to acquire many horses, since the Lord has said to you, you shall never return that way again. Then he says, and he shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he acquire for himself excessive silver and gold. So very simple, don't be excessive. Kings can't be excessive. Excessive wives, excessive riches, and excessive horses. This brings us to the last point. The godly leader must protect his or her heart from the idols of success. This is not to say as Christians that we can't be successful. Okay, that's not what I'm saying. But with success comes the temptation to idolize the things of success, like the power and the opportunities and the wealth that comes along with it. The temptation to idolize success and not the God behind the success. All your success has been granted to you by God ultimately. So let's look at some of these ironic statements behind Solomon's success. Okay, look at his wealth. Chapter 10, verse 21. All King Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold, and all the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon, his other house, were of pure gold. None were of silver. Silver was not considered as anything in the days of Solomon. Verse 27 says, and the king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stone. So not a good investment. You might as well invest in stones or rocks. Now, that's just one verse, okay? The story tells us that there was not a greater king than Solomon in terms of wealth. Now, the author seems, on the surface level, seems to be bragging about Solomon. You should see our king. He has so much gold, he didn't know what to do with it, so he made cups out of it. That's how impressive our king is. But the context gives us a different meaning. He's not allowed to have excessive silver and gold. What about horses? I mean, what is the big deal with horses? Well, in that time, in the East especially, horses were a status symbol of might and military strength. They were not used for transport or agricultural purposes. They were a status symbol. And so the law says very clearly, don't have many horses, especially horses from Egypt. Because God didn't want his people going back to Egypt under any circumstances. He said, you were rescued people, you were slaves, I've rescued you, now you are your own nation in the promised land. You're not to go back there, even for horses. Chapter 10, verse 26, look at this. And Solomon gathered together chariots and horsemen. He had 1,400 chariots. So you need horses to pull them. And 12,000 horsemen. They need horses. Where did these horses come from? And Solomon's import of horses was from Egypt and Kew. But again, the author doesn't seem to be coming down on Solomon. It seems like he's bragging about him. But he's kind of like bragging about him with the, you know, those inverted commas. Or, you know, kind of like winking, has a wry smile on his face. And then, of course, there's the woman. And the law clearly states he must not have excessive wives. Look at chapter 11, verse 1. He says, now King Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh. So never mind horses from Egypt. He just goes and marries the Pharaoh's daughter. Then he goes, Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonian, and Hittite women. From all the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the people of Israel, you shall not enter into marriage with them. Neither shall they with you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. What did Solomon do? Text says, Solomon clung to these in love. He had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines. And his wives turned away his heart. For when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods. And his heart was not wholly true to the Lord his God, as was the heart of David, his father. I forgot to mention this as well, that it took 7 years to build the temple, but it took 13 years to complete his own house and Pharaoh's daughter, whom he married. Her house also took 13 years. And so no more ironic statements. The author is just straight to the chase here. Solomon's heart turned from God to these foreign gods. I mean, God promised him. He promised Solomon, he said, if you remain true to me, if your heart remains true to me, I will give you long life and a long reign as king. Instead, he only reigned for 40 years. So later on, the story tells us that he actually became very harsh with his people. He treated them harshly, and God became angry with him. And so after Solomon died, God split the nation of Israel. He was going to split it while Solomon was still alive, but out of respect for David, he said, I'll wait for you to die, and then I'm going to split this nation. This unified nation that has never experienced so much peace, I'm going to split it to a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom. All because Solomon didn't guard his heart from the idols of success. Now, don't get me wrong. There's nothing wrong with money. There's nothing wrong with being married or desiring to be married. Those are good things. But when a good thing becomes an ultimate thing, it becomes a bad thing. Because an ultimate thing has the full attention of your mind and has the full affections of your heart. The text tells us Solomon clung to his wives. They became the ultimate thing, and their gods became the ultimate thing in his life, and they turned his heart from God. And so what are we clinging to? What are you clinging to? Because what you cling to will turn your heart. Maybe you're sitting here thinking, well, I'm doing okay because A, I don't have enough money, and B, my business is not doing very well. My salary makes a brief appearance on the 25th and it's gone by the second. So I'm okay in terms of idols of success. But the successful person clings to what he has and what he still desires. The unsuccessful person clings to what he still desires. He clings to the success that he desires. Both can become idols. And so here's a question you can ask yourself. It's a good self-reflection question to ask every now and again. You can say something like this. If this thing or this person had to be taken away from me, I would just want to stop living. What is that thing? Who is that person? It could be your wife, it could be your husband, it could be your kids, it could be your lifestyle, it could be your job, it could be your ministry, it could be your ability to do this or do that. You know, if something had happened to me and I couldn't do that anymore, that would be the end for me. So once you've identified the idol or the idols in your life, how do you then get rid of them? You get rid of it by replacing it with the expulsive power of a greater idol. A greater idol will replace a lesser idol. I could simply say to you, it needs to be Jesus, because I'm standing behind a pulpit. But let me show you rather, let me show you what Jesus did for you by comparing him to Solomon. Because maybe you're sitting here going, well, Solomon had it good. I mean, that's a good life, lots of riches, very clever, lots of wives. I mean, the dude had it all. Okay, let me just compare him to Jesus. Right, read this with me. Jesus did not have excessive silver and gold. He was rich, and yet for our sake, he became poor so that we by his poverty might become rich. He gave it up so that we might become rich. Secondly, Jesus did not have any horses. He had to borrow a donkey to ride into Jerusalem and was crucified for us. Lastly, Jesus did not have many wives. He has one bride. If you think, what? I thought you were single. We are his bride. Believers are his bride, whom he died for, that he might sanctify her, sanctify us, and present us in splendor, holy and blameless before him forever. That's a king worth following. That's an idol worth clinging to and worshiping so that your heart turns to him forever. Can you imagine what your leadership would look like if your heart was constantly turned on Jesus? How would that change the way you run your business? How would that change the way you love your wife, you love your husband, you love your kids? How would that change the way you handle your finances? How would that change the way you lead yourself? How would that change the way you study? Because Jesus is our greatest Solomon. He is the ultimate king. And so we guard our hearts by turning to him. And when we do that, we live for his glory and for the good of others. Let's pray. Father, I want to thank you for sending your son to die in our place so that by your sovereign grace and through faith in him, we might have new hearts. New hearts that want to live for you. New hearts that want to beat for you. But we know that we have to protect them because there are so many idols out in the world that are threatening to take the affections of our hearts and the focus of our mind off you. But those hearts were designed only for you, to find pleasure in you and in pleasure in serving you. So Holy Spirit, I ask that you would protect our hearts, that you would show us just how magnificent Jesus is in what he accomplished on the cross for us. Won't you firmly entrench him in our hearts as our King and Lord, to serve him for his glory and for the good of others, because we know that this will bring us so much joy. In Jesus' name.